The Roots of Global Networks. When the commander of the U.S. Pacific Command, PACCOM, is in his large corner office at Camp Smith in Oahu, Hawaii, his four-star flag flies high on the pole in front of the building. That flagpole might be seen, however, as the epicenter of something more than the world's leading military command. It is the center point of a series of relationships, political, economic, and security-related, that tie the leaders of the U.S. military in the Pacific to their counterparts throughout their AOR, Area of Responsibility. In this respect, it is like other major U.S. defense operations, a very national undertaking with broadly global ties. One former PACCOM commander told me that these connections were increasingly part of the job. We have more direct ties with the people and leadership of the region than most other branches of the U.S. government. We have become the diplomats in many cases. We are tied to defense cooperation, which has a big business component. We may be powerful in many ways, but we also know security is increasingly a partnership deal. Through better cooperation comes strength. And at the heart of a lot of this are the historical and carefully developed networks of ties between me, my top guys, and the military leaders of the region. It is a comment I heard echoed by U.S. and foreign military leaders in every part of the world. Warfighters find that, increasingly, they too are global networkers. Tradition means a lot among military elites, in no small part because they share so much training and because history is such an important element of the instructions and culture that empower them. Every commander of PACCOM, for instance, has been a naval officer. When President Bush announced his intention to name an Air Force officer to the post, it created such an uproar he had to reverse his decision. Of the last five PACCOM commanders, four were graduates of the U.S. Naval Academy at Annapolis, which has a historical role as the principal training ground for professional naval officers in the United States. For example, one recent PACCOM commander, Admiral Dennis Denny Blair, who served from 1999 to 2002, was a member of the Annapolis graduating class of 1968. His class also produced, among others, the current chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Michael Mullen, former Navy Secretary James Webb, current Marine Commandant General Michael Hagey, and infamous Marine Lieutenant Colonel and former National Security Council staffer Oliver North. The preceding class produced the chairman of the Joint Chiefs who came before Mullen, Marine General Peter Pace. Pace's vice chairman, Edmund Giambastiani, was the class of 1970. The U.S. Military Academy at West Point and the U.S. Air Force Academy have similar records of producing the top cadre in their services, as well as many senior government and corporate leaders. Many of their graduates also interact with the rising stars who later lead alongside them in graduate or professional programs at institutions like the National War College and the National Defense University in Washington, D.C., the Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. Programs like these, found in every country, knit together leadership cadres in important ways. For example, Denny Blair was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford at the same time as future President Bill Clinton, the man who approved his appointment to be what was then called CINCPAC, Commander-in-Chief Pacific Command. Blair, a sixth-generation naval officer, was also a White House fellow, participating in a program designed to identify rising stars with an interest in public service. In his class of White House fellows in 1975 to 76 was the West Point graduate, former Rhodes Scholar, and future U.S. Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, Wesley Clark. Such training programs have been defining the future elite of the U.S. military for 200 years. More recently, they have also started training an increasing number of young future officers from other countries. The Naval Academy, for instance, currently has students from Guyana, Honduras, Ireland, Malaysia, the Maldives, Mauritius, the Philippines, Singapore, Taiwan, and Thailand. West Point has a similar tradition, even having produced three former foreign heads of state: Anastasio Somoza, former president of Nicaragua, Fidel Ramos, former president of the Philippines, and Jose Maria Figueres, former president of Costa Rica, and former co-CEO of the World Economic Forum. These efforts at globalizing the networks of U.S. military elites have become an important tool of U.S. foreign policy for several decades. One such program, the International Military Education and Training Program, has grown dramatically since the early 1990s and now offers military instruction to representatives of more than 130 countries. These programs not only spread American military methods and ideologies, but also benefit the United States in a variety of other ways, from generating goodwill to supporting U.S. weapons sales to establishing networks U.S. commanders can use. One of the most controversial of such programs is the training program the U.S. military has run since 1946 for Latin American military leaders. Known for much of its existence as the School of the Americas, the program changed its name in 2000 due to its association with human rights violations committed by some of its graduates, often in the context of America's Cold War struggle with perceived communist threats. The program is now called the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, and its graduates include a stunning collection of notorious names: Argentina's former president, General Leopoldo Galtieri, known both for the Falklands fiasco and for accusations concerning the disappearance of leftist opponents; the interim Argentine president, Roberto Eduardo Viola, who spent nearly two decades in prison for human rights violations during that country's dirty war; the Ecuadorian dictator, General Guillermo Rodriguez; the Salvadorian Death Squad leader, Major Roberto Dabuisson; Guatemalan general and former de facto president, José Efraín Ríos Montt, whose regime was responsible for a long list of documented atrocities during that country's civil war; Panama's Manuel Noriega, who later ran afoul of his former sponsors in the United States; and Peru's discredited and corrupt spymaster, Vladimiro Montesinos, to name but a few. It is easy to see, given the record of such men and the support they received from the United States throughout their careers, how the program could grow to be seen as a liability. Nonetheless, it also illustrates what a powerful and effective tool such training programs can be, having given the United States a network of powerful friends who shared U.S. views, or went beyond them, with regard to the communist threat in the region during the Cold War. Today's training programs serve a similar purpose, although hopefully with less toxic byproducts. Much like Harvard and Yale among the world's business leaders, these military programs carry a great deal of prestige abroad. General John Jumper, who served as U.S. Air Force Chief of Staff during the George W. Bush administration, told me that, "If you go to any of these countries, you will find them wearing the accoutrements of one school in the United States. The first thing they'll bring up is that they went to this war college or that war college. It is actually a bigger deal for them and their countries than it is for us." In addition to training ties, military-to-military programs such as joint exercises, meetings under the auspices of key alliances, and other similar cooperation efforts are regularly cited by leaders as being essential. Admiral Dennis Blair said to me, "The mill-to-mill communications channels were often better than the political ones or the diplomatic ones. I remember when we started to tackle the crisis in Timor, while talks via other channels were stalled, I could pick up the phone and talk to my Australian counterparts and find solutions, move things along. We had a long-established relationship. There was no false formality in our exchanges. We could cut to the chase." General Anthony Zini, the blunt-talking, street-smart Marine who was the sink at CENTCOM, the U.S. Central Command covering the Middle East, offered similar stories. One relationship that proved particularly significant was the one he developed with a rising Pakistani military officer named Pervez Musharraf during multiple visits to that country. When Musharraf later led a military takeover in Pakistan and became one of the most important leaders in the world to the United States, Zini was asked on more than one occasion to draw on his close ties to help resolve sensitive issues. A former member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff observed to me, "There are deep, dark secrets in this diplomatic process that I have never understood. We make it harder for ourselves than necessary. For example, on the military side, we have an Association of South American Air Chiefs. They get together twice a year. Most of these guys just want you to teach them how to fix their C-130s that are from 1965. With just a pittance of spare parts that is pocket change compared to the money we spend around the world, we do wonders for these folks. But it's hard to get it done. Penny wise and pound foolish, I'd say." Leaders find the military-to-military ties useful even when fissures exist in this network. Jumper points out that, in the midst of differences over Iraq, during the height of our anxiety with the French, I talked to the French air chief once, and the message was simple. We'll get over this sooner or later. It introduces an element of stability that, when the time comes to reconcile, I think it makes it easier. And it keeps people from being nervous. And we have so much in common. For all of our issues with them, the French are there almost every time we are. They're not there unconditionally, and they have to call home before they can do anything. It's not always wonderful, but it works better than people might guess, judging from the headlines. General Jim Jones, the outgoing U.S. Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, provided another perspective on the current role of U.S. military leaders as members of the global superclass. Our conversation took place at one of the many coffee lounges at the Congress Center in Davos. When I asked him about the relevance of the tight relationships among transatlantic military elites to running an enormous and complex military alliance like NATO, he responded, "If one considers the current political relationship between the EU and NATO, it is clear that, at the political level, there is great difficulty in having any meaningful political discourse. Conversely, at the military-to-military level, there is no such difficulty. We know how to make the situation work. We know how to work together. And we know how to focus on the important military issues affecting interoperability. Such personal and professional relationships have been formed since the creation of NATO itself, and today they spill over and benefit the EU as well. Those who select military careers tend to build on such relationships, which become very long-lasting." Jones, a tall man who sat folded somewhat uncomfortably into a modern Euro-style chair, continued, "I would make a personal observation. Relationships in the international political world don't appear to have the same personal bonding quality that is developed in the international military community. It also seems to me that personal rotations at the very senior levels occur with greater frequency on the political diplomatic side of things than they do in the military. It is probably unrealistic to think that the cohesion of the two groups can really ever be expected to be the same." Citing specific instances from his recent career, Jones offered, "As an example, at the most recent summit in Riga, Latvia, at the last minute, Turkey came up with a much-needed force contribution for Afghanistan. I give credit to the Turkish Chief of Defense, Çavuş, for having been able to convince his government that this was not only essential, but the right thing to do. The Turkish decision, which came only after extreme military pressure, showed that international military cohesion can be effective, most especially when critically needed. Another characteristic of working within the community of top military leaders is that in Europe, chiefs of defense are rarely heard in the media. In other words, their way of operating is mostly behind the scenes. In my farewell comments to the Chodes of NATO, I pointed out that this was not an ideal situation and that they, as individuals and as groups, would be much more effective if they were able to have a more public role in terms of their national policies and those of the alliance. There exists, I am painfully aware, a very real difference in our side of the Atlantic, as contrasted with the European side of the Atlantic, as regards what the chiefs of defense are permitted to discuss publicly. For that, I am extremely grateful to my country. European chodes are comfortable, excessively so in my view, with letting their political masters do that kind of work. In most nations, it is either a matter of law or firm policy that this be so, rather than passivity on the part of the chodes. European military leaders with whom I have spoken were, true to Jones's observation, more reluctant than their American counterparts to go on the record. One senior British officer did tell me, though, that, "For all of us, working together can be a matter of the greatest urgency, of survival in the worst case. And the international system on the political side just doesn't work very well. So who is going to step in and fill the void if we do not?" It echoed a comment made to me by Colin Powell. "I have developed many good relationships, real friendships over the years with senior officials, political leaders, diplomats, and military men. Maybe it is because I was in the army for most of my career. Maybe it is because of the bond between soldiers, which is great, but those relationships have been special, and I have turned to them often when other channels were stalled. I think sometimes the problems we have in the international system, the weaknesses of that system, are offset and managed through informal channels, invisible ones that have proven to be vitally important." Green is not just the color of the uniforms. Following his tenure at NATO, General Jim Jones, often candidly critical of some of America's plans in Iraq, spurned offers to become Deputy Secretary of State and to assume another command. Instead, he entered the private sector, where he was recruited to head a major energy policy initiative by the Chamber of Commerce. He also joined the board of Invacare Corporation, which sells medical products. In this respect, he was both like and different from many of his colleagues. Most go on to senior corporate positions. Indeed, many step into the revolving door and head into the defense industry sector. This despite assertions by many that the revolving door is less important than before, thanks to legislation designed to curb the potential conflicts of interest it produced. From the perspective of the corporations, why not seek advice from the people who know the area best and who have the most hands-on experience? Said one senior executive of America's 13th largest defense contractor, Science Applications International Corporation, "Who better to get to tell us the needs of troops on the ground to work with us than guys like Tony Zini?" On the other hand, a senior defense contractor observed, "Look, there's a lot of talk about a shadow government, and I am here to tell you it's real. On every level, the connections between our company and the government are amazingly deep." It's a delicate balance. Military leaders need to earn a living when they leave the armed forces, and they should not be penalized for having chosen to serve their country. Nor should their country be deprived of their know-how or the experience for which the country has already paid. Having said that, it is a short trip from an inadvertent old boys network to the military-industrial complex self-dealing that has, in the past, in countries all over the world, led to overspending, delays, overlooked flaws, and outright corruption. In its international form, it has also had an impact on the important role that arms sales have in foreign policy, leading to the promotion of symbolic deals that sometimes involve weapons systems that may not be optimum for countries involved, but have been advocated by well-connected interests in the defense establishment, as in the case of the $20 billion 10-year arms deal the United States began to develop with Saudi Arabia in 2007 as a way of countering Iranian influence in the Persian Gulf. While the program had yet to be reviewed by Congress at the time of this recording, controversy was already brewing over the inclusion of precision munitions in the package, sought by Saudis, advocated by the U.S. manufacturers of the arms, but feared by others, including the Israelis, who see it as giving the Saudis a new and threatening capability. At the heart of the challenge in striking a balance between military, industry, and government lies a system that has, as noted earlier, long blurred the boundaries between the public and the private segments of the defense industry. Take those past five commanders of the Pacific Command. The predecessor of the current commander is Admiral Thomas Fargo, a compact former submariner. Fargo was such a clipped model of his breed that when Scott Glenn was researching the role of Captain Bartman Cuso for the movie The Hunt for Red October, he modeled him after Fargo, then a subcommander. When Fargo left the Navy, he became the president of Trex Enterprises and the chairman of Loewe Corporation and Sago Systems, all high-tech defense firms. He also joined the boards of Hawaiian Holdings and Hawaiian Electric Industries, a utility on the same islands where PACCOM is based. Fargo's predecessor, Dennis Blair, not only became president of the influential Institute for Defense Analysis, but also joined the board of defense contractors EDO Corporation and Tyco International. Unfortunately for Blair, when it was discovered that the Institute had completed a government report on the future of the F-22 Raptor fighter jet project and that EDO was a contractor producing parts for the F-22, a brouhaha ensued over the perceived conflict of interest. Few people have such impeccable reputations for ethical behavior as Blair, and close observers see it as a problem of not being sufficiently sensitive to appearances. But the situation illustrates many dimensions of the ongoing ties that exist and the problems associated with the ties. Blair's predecessor was Admiral Joseph Pruer, now on the boards of Merrill Lynch, Fluor Corporation, Emerson Electric, the Warnick Company, New York Life, and defense contractor DynCorp International. Another recent sink at PACCOM, Admiral Chuck Larson, is on the board of Northrop Grumman, the world's number three defense contractor. This is business as usual, and good business at that. There is nothing inherently wrong with it, but it helps maintain the power of those at the top, whether in the military, government, or corporate arena. Not surprisingly, a similar pattern of connections exists at the boards of the top defense contractors. Take the Big Three alone, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and Northrop Grumman. Lockheed Martin is the largest defense contractor in the world, a mammoth corporation that took in $36 billion in defense revenues in 2006. On its board, you will find the former Undersecretary of Defense, E.C. Pete Aldridge, the former Commander, Strategic Command, Admiral James O. Ellis, the former Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security and Coast Guard Commandant, Admiral James Loy, and the former Supreme Allied Commander in Europe and Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Joseph Ralston. Second in the ranks of defense contractors is Boeing, with defense sales of $30 billion, but an almost identical amount from commercial sales. Thus, its board is not as heavily laden with former military and Defense Department executives, although it does include General Jones, as well as a former White House Chief of Staff, a former Commerce Secretary, and a former Assistant Secretary of State. Number three, Northrop Grumman, has as board members Admiral Larson and General Richard Myers, former head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The former Congressman Vic Fazio, a one-time member of the House Armed Services Committee, and the former National Security Council staffer and former chairman of the National Defense Panel, Philip Odeen. The revolving door does, by its nature, revolve. Many drawn from the corporate world spend time high in the federal policymaking and procurement decision-making bureaucracies. When Donald Rumsfeld was replaced by Robert Gates, critics noted that he had been a board member of SAIC, TRW, a defense contractor that is now part of Northrop Grumman, and another contractor, the Charles Stark Draper Laboratory. But the current or recent high-level ties have also included Peter Teets, was president and chief operating officer at Lockheed, is now Undersecretary of the Air Force. Gordon England, was Vice President of General Dynamics and Secretary of the Navy, is now Deputy Secretary of Defense. Michael Wynn was a top executive at Lockheed and General Dynamics, is now Secretary of the Air Force. James Roche was Vice President of Northrop Grumman, served as Secretary of the Air Force from 2001 to 2005. Philip J. Perry was a major lobbyist for Lockheed Martin, is now General Counsel for the Department of Homeland Security. His wife is a daughter of Dick Cheney. And Rudy DeLeon was Deputy Secretary of Defense and a Senior Vice President at Boeing. Ties between political and industry power arenas are extensive and are not limited to top-tier positions. According to the New York Times, former Lockheed executives serve on the Defense Policy Board, the Defense Science Board, and the Homeland Security Advisory Council, which help make military and intelligence policy and pick weapons for future battles. Nor do such ties always involve official titles and appointments. Boeing CEO James McNerney has sustained a friendly relationship with President George W. Bush since their days together on the Yale baseball team, and has attended elite White House functions, like an official dinner for Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh in 2005. Lockheed CEO Robert Stevens was also among the 134 guests at the dinner, which was notable for an administration not given to social events. The following year, Stevens attended an economic roundtable in Cancun and sat at Bush's side, near then-Mexican President Vicente Fox and Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper. The blending of military and defense industry leadership cadres is significant on several levels. Power is concentrated among a few people with similar backgrounds and, on key issues, similar outlooks about core concerns, such as the size of defense budgets, which programs to promote and which to cut, or where the greatest imminent threats may lie. These similarities predispose those at the top to sharing special relationships based on aligned interests, which predispose them to certain behaviors, such as the granting of special business advantages. This might be as modest as offering casual hints as to when programs will be bid out, or what features will be especially valued in a proposal, or they may be tips about what is on the mind of key decision makers elsewhere in a process. It can come in the form of hiring valued friends or of placing ads that support particular political agendas. Bernard Schwartz, one of America's leading defense industry CEOs for more than two decades, defended the revolving door. If a uniform guy gets out of the service and he has a lot of friends, 2 years later when he is in business, he is going to be able to call upon them. And so, what is new? I mean, business is like that too. Human beings are like that. I do not see anything criminal about that necessarily. It is natural for it to happen that someone may say, I play tennis with a guy, and I don't only play with him because he is a flag officer, but maybe once or twice during the course of our friendship I'm able to say, hey, you want to look at this? Or maybe this is something you ought to buy, or we have an interest in this. But I think that is a human behavior. It is hard to legislate human behavior. I'm suggesting that something would be lost if we did somehow prevent individuals from investing something in the people that they trust and work with. Consolidation and concentration of military power. One of the most significant aspects of the defense industry in the United States today is the degree to which it has consolidated during the past decade. Beginning in the mid-1990s, reduced defense budgets and the glut of defense industrial capacity left over from the Cold War led arms suppliers and contracting firms to merge at an unprecedented rate. Consolidation was welcomed and encouraged by the government, which offered reimbursement for transition costs, and by Wall Street as well. In less than a decade, what has been more than 50 major defense suppliers had been consolidated into only five or six dominant firms. The executives of Lockheed Martin themselves have said that the concentration of power among military contractors is more intense than in any other sector of business outside banking. Since the attacks of 9/11 and wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, business has been booming. The top five U.S. contractors, Lockheed, Boeing, Northrop, General Dynamics, and Raytheon, have increased sales 10% a year every year since 2001. The Pentagon's budget has grown by a nearly identical average of 11% during the same period. In 2005, the profits of the top five rose 25% from the year before to $12.94 billion. While the United States far and away dominates the global arms market, several countries have made inroads into the industry, particularly Britain. Mike Turner earns a place on the list of military industrial elites as the chief executive of BAE, British Aerospace, the United Kingdom's largest arms manufacturer and the third most profitable in the world. BAE is a global giant, employing nearly 100,000 people on five continents, and makes 26% of its sales in the United States, an anomaly in a market dominated by U.S. firms. It is the seventh biggest military contractor in the United States, the only foreign Pentagon supplier to make the top 10. And as the New York Times reported, the company has special access to some of the Defense Department's most highly classified programs. Of course, that privileged position may change following revelations that BAE allegedly bribed Saudi Prince Bandar bin Sultan to facilitate a $54 billion arms deal. Britain's defense industry is an exemplar of globalization and trade liberalization. The most open defense market in the world, it buys three-quarters of its arms through open competition, forcing British firms to compete with U.S. and European companies. Turner has consistently protested the system, saying it hurts Britain's indigenous industry, and has openly floated the possibility of merging with a U.S. firm. If you add up what is spent on defense in Europe and the United States, it's clear where our future is, he observed in 2003. The industry's tendency toward consolidation, especially in the last quarter century, has strengthened the leadership class at its core, giving a few individuals greater influence. In 2006, only a dozen or so companies around the world accounted for the majority of international defense revenues. Before the end of the Cold War, power within the industry was much more diffuse. But as the industry consolidated on an international level, the leaders of the largest firms emerged as a clique of powerful individuals, each with his own ties to government leaders. One result of this concentrated network is that, in addition to consolidating at an unprecedented rate, defense firms around the world are becoming more and more global in orientation. Cooperation among nations in certain aspects of arms production is nothing new, but in the past 20 years, international arms collaboration has expanded significantly in pace and scope. Not only are national companies trading more information and weapons with foreign governments than ever before, but they are also taking part in strategic alliances, joint ventures, and even mergers with their counterparts overseas. The transnational cooperation of the industry has been especially marked in Western Europe and has expanded to include many countries in the developing world as well, providing access to information and technology to develop national defense industrial bases. While defense firms have become more integrated into a global network, they have also become more autonomous, taking the initiative in restructuring the international defense industry base, a role formerly taken by the state. Naturally, they advocate for the kinds of projects that suit them, either by virtue of what they are best positioned to produce, what produces the biggest margins, or what they perceive their best contacts within the military as being interested in. This in turn leads to a self-perpetuating process in which what was produced is likely to be most like what will be produced next. Incrementalism triumphs because it is more profitable and it builds on past efforts to sell an idea or the military doctrine underlying it. Thus, again, we see the pattern. a few leaders from a few big companies playing a dominant market role and assuming responsibility once held by public institutions for decisions affecting very broad cross-sections of the public at large, including decisions that play a role in shaping a nation's defense doctrine. They are particularly active as advocates of big and/or expensive weapons systems, such as carrier battle groups, major aircraft, and high-tech space weaponry, all of which are both profitable and offer maximum prestige to service leaders. Real change and reevaluation are resisted. Turning the military-industrial complex is a little bit like turning a battleship, in an age in which smaller, faster ships with smaller crews launching unmanned aircraft is probably a better way to go. Networks among defense firms. The interconnections among companies in the defense industry exist mainly on the national level, in a complex balance of cooperation and competition. For example, Lockheed and Boeing have been entangled in a lawsuit since 1998, when Lockheed sued Boeing for stealing proprietary data in order to win a contract. Yet they continue to merge and collaborate on lucrative contracts, such as a mammoth satellite launch bid in 2005. Likewise, BAE frequently engages in fierce competition with number two British contractor, EADS, European Aeronautic Defense and Space Company, yet partners with it in joint ventures like a major missile manufacturing deal in 2001. Firms most often cooperate in the face of foreign competition, which is ever more common in the globalizing industry. Yet at the same time, the industry is increasingly dispensing with national borders and creating alliances to address a global market. When Ronald Sugar arrived at Lockheed, he placed a new emphasis on building international partnerships with foreign firms. "We see the world as being connected," he told the Washington Post in 2004, "by financial, trade, and security interests. Such partnerships can be complicated, especially with a U.S. Congress reluctant to share technology and domestic jobs." But if Turner of the BAE has anything to say about it, such protectionist sentiments will continue to fade. Notions of us versus them have limited applicability in the global economy, he told a Washington, D.C. audience in May 2006. "Open markets help us all." This is a direct contradiction with his earlier quoted concerns about protecting indigenous U.K. productive capacity. But despite the apparent disconnect between the two positions, they are linked in one fundamental aspect. They are completely consistent in the way they support the interests of BAE's shareholders and leadership. They're all in a tiny room. The top tier of the global military establishment, defense ministers, chiefs of staff, meet frequently in fairly intimate, officially orchestrated settings. The same is often true when the industrial sector is involved and arms deals are negotiated. Several venues offer an opportunity for the gathering of the military-industrial superclass, military professionals, civilian policymakers, arms manufacturers, and defense contractors. Begun in 1962, the Munich Conference on Security Policy is one such forum for top-level officials to convene and collaborate on U.S.-European security and defense issues. The conference expanded greatly in 1999 to include representatives from Eastern Europe and Asia, as well as members of the media and the arms industry. One senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations calls it a useful barometer of transatlantic relations. The list of attendees in 2006 was packed with power players, including Donald Rumsfeld, then Defense Minister of France Michel Alliot-Marie, the EADS CEO Tom Enders, the U.S. Senator John McCain, Die Zeit editor Joseph Joffe, NATO Secretary General Jaap de Hoop Scheffer, and the Bose Allen Hamilton VP James Woolsey. Comparing it to other events like Davos, Bilderberg, or meetings of the Trilateral Commission, Richard Holbrook told me, "For my personal interests, the Munich Security Conference is by far the best because it's very focused. That is a real meeting of the international national security elites. Originally just U.S. and Europe, but now it includes India, Israel. China comes, and they pack 200 people into a room smaller than this one. So you're jammed in with Don Rumsfeld, Angela Merkel, John McCain, Hillary Clinton, and the ministers of defense, and King Abdullah, and President of Georgia Saakashvili. They're all in a tiny room. The discussion is serious, focused, and sustained. That's my favorite conference. The meeting revolves around debates over central issues, such as how NATO's mission should evolve, or the sensitive matter of how it should work out of its historical theater of operations, or how to address the future expansion of NATO capabilities into Eastern and Central Europe. It also has important implications for arms deals, as discussions range from questions of systems interoperability to the merits of deploying anti-missile defenses and new weapons platforms, even as those discussions advance pending sales and prime buyers for new ones. The Shangri-La Dialogue is another important venue for defense and military policymakers in the Asian-Pacific region. Begun in 2002, the dialogue aims to serve as the best available vehicle in the Asia-Pacific region for developing and channeling astute and effective public policy on defense and security. The conference is organized by the International Institute for Strategic Studies, IISS, and sponsored by leading defense and arms manufacturers, BAE, Boeing, EADS, Northrop Grumman, and Mitsubishi, among others. The board of IISS comprises a number of cross-cluster global figures: David Ignatius, the Washington Post columnist; Thomas Pickering, formerly a VP at Boeing, Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs 1997 to 2001, and a lieutenant commander in the Navy; Robert Ellsworth, a VP at IISS, a former Kansas congressman, the ambassador to NATO 1969 to 71, an assistant and deputy secretary of defense 1974 to 77, a board member of General Dynamics, and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Officials from 22 countries, including 9 defense ministers, were present at the 2006 meeting in Singapore. IISS also runs the Gulf Dialogue, which brings defense and foreign policy authorities from the Middle East together with global powers like the United States, China, and Russia. These meetings offer important forums where the ties at the core of military-to-military cooperation, so important even in humanitarian interventions as in the aftermath of the 2004 tsunami that devastated much of Southeast Asia's coastal regions, are cemented and new ones formed. Like other meetings of elites, they become venues in which conventional wisdom is shaped. In this case, about threats, about the reliability of partners, about elements of existing military doctrine within an alliance. The privatization of the military, a two-way street. As of this recording, there are approximately 170,000 U.S. troops on the ground in Iraq. Less well known is the fact that there are another 125,000 trained contractors, many armed and playing roles traditionally allocated to the national military. These guns for hire are typically former military personnel, but they have moved over to a rapidly growing industry, one that has taken firms like North Carolina-based Blackwater, for instance, from virtually nothing to a reported $100 million in revenues in just a decade. The firm, run by an ultra-right-wing heir to an auto parts fortune named Eric Prince, has won diplomatic security contracts with the State Department worth, over a multi-year period, $750 million in just the past 3 years. Blackwater also cashed in on Hurricane Katrina, winning contracts worth $250,000 a day. Prince, a former Navy SEAL who has donated approximately $200,000 to Republican politicians, took a company that made firing ranges and transformed it. As of this recording, Blackwater has personnel working in 9 countries worldwide, a fleet of more than 20 aircraft, and a database of more than 20,000 additional troops on standby. In fewer than 10 years, Prince created a company that is today seen as a pioneer among private military firms, or PMFs. PMFs are the less visible relatives of traditional fighting forces, but they are becoming a potent participant in the dynamic of military-state relations. In his study of the privatized military industry, P.W. Singer describes the rise of PMFs as an overall global pattern with operations on every continent except Antarctica, including relative backwaters and key strategic zones. PMFs are essentially private companies hired by governments to provide a wide range of military and security services. These include servicing of advanced weapons, facility protection and personnel security, translation, interrogation, and training for military and police forces. They usually exclude actual combat. PMFs have been around since at least the 1950s, when the United Kingdom and South Africa created similar groups of mercenaries to train and fight in the Middle East, Angola, and Sierra Leone. The United States also hired private contractors to train Vietnamese military and police forces in the 1960s and 70s. There are now about 35 major PMFs in the United States, including now familiar names such as Kellogg, Brown & Root, Halliburton, DynCorp, and Trident, in addition to the infamous Blackwater. These firms often have ties to larger defense conglomerates. Northrop Grumman owns Vinnell Corporation in Fairfax, Virginia, for instance. Vinnell exemplifies the history and current function of PMFs in the United States. Founded by retired military officials, it has been operating in Saudi Arabia for more than 30 years, with the primary responsibility of training the Saudi National Guard, a force of 100,000 servicemen who protect the monarchy against potential threat from the standing army. Chalmers Johnson, author of The Sorrows of Empire, writes that over just the past few years, Vinnell has constructed, run, written doctrine for, and staffed 5 Saudi military academies, 7 shooting ranges, and a healthcare system, while training and equipping 4 Saudi mechanized brigades and 5 infantry brigades. Saudi Arabia has, in turn, funneled hundreds of millions of dollars into major defense corporations to equip those forces. The implications of such relationships are significant. If PMFs do in fact represent the new business face of warfare, governments will no longer have a monopoly on violence, and state power will be greatly undermined. Crucially, private firms are also exempt from legislative or public oversight. Indeed, L. Paul Bremer, the U.S. administrator in Iraq, decreed that individual contractors were immunized from prosecution in Iraq, placing them beyond the reach of the law, where some have allegedly operated. In the United States, contracts require the approval of both the State Department and the Pentagon. This allows leaders to short-circuit democracy by turning over important foreign policy tasks to outside, unaccountable companies. Or, as one journalist describes it, heads of these companies can ignore the consequences and fudge the responsibility. As the PMF phenomenon grows, states will have to adjust their foreign policies to account for their presence and to better control them. Blackwater's employees include a number of top former Pentagon and intelligence community officials, among them the former Bush administration counter-terror official Kofor Black, the former Pentagon Inspector General Joseph Schmitz, the former Associate Deputy Director of the CIA's Operations Directorate Robert Richer, and the former top CIA Latin American operative Rick Prado. A fall 2006 article in Harper's Magazine described how the revolving door has worked for Blackwater. Richer is a former head of the CIA's Near East Division and has long served in Amman, where, for a period beginning in 1999, he held the post of station chief. For years, he was the agency's point man with Jordan's King Abdullah, with whom he developed an extraordinarily close relationship. There have been some ups and downs in our relationship with Jordan, but the king has always been on good terms with the CIA, said a person familiar with the situation. The king's primary relationship is always with the CIA, not the American ambassador. After Richer retired, sources say, he helped Blackwater land a lucrative deal with the Jordanian government to provide the same sort of training offered by the CIA. Millions of dollars that the CIA invested in Jordan walked out the door with Richer. Many of the Blackwater troops on the ground in Iraq, troops that had central missions like the protection of Paul Bremer, are paid substantially more than U.S. military personnel. They often make in a month what soldiers make in a year, with some earning considerably more than U.S. cabinet secretaries. A critic within a top 15 contractor sees something different. Here's what has happened over the years. Guys have gotten smart. They discovered they could do job X within a government for government wages, but that if they did it in the private sector, they would make much more. So they moved, and through their influence, they moved the resource flows from those paying for government work to those hiring somebody else to do it. Overseas, there are strikingly different perspectives on privatization of the military. During the massive reforms of the 1990s, Chinese military leaders in the People's Liberation Army, PLA, became avatars of change in the name of their self-interest. In fact, it is widely believed that one of the reasons Hong Kong's transition was so smooth and its role as a capitalist entrepot was so carefully preserved is that senior Chinese military officials needed Hong Kong's functioning banking system to preserve and build their own personal wealth. The newfound appreciation for capitalism that overtook the PLA during the 1990s has made a number of them members of the global superclass, including Ren Zhengfei, now president of Huawei Technologies, who turned a $9 million loan from a state bank into one of China's leading international telecoms. Huawei, offering itself as a low-cost rival to big-name suppliers from the West, capitalized on knowledge obtained by Ren when he served as a technical researcher in China's military. The PLA also supported the company, much as Russia's former KGB leaders nurtured, at least for a while, oligarchs like Mikhail Khodorkovsky. The army needed state-of-the-art communications capabilities, and to the extent that senior military officials also profited financially from the growth of this firm, all the better. Ren, who spent a decade in the army, reportedly runs the company along military lines and keeps a low profile, but he is having a harder time staying below the radar now that the company's revenues exceed $11 billion. Other PLA holdings in the 1990s ranged from the plush Palace Hotel in Beijing to securities firms like the failed J&A Securities, and included other prominent enterprises such as Great Wall Telecom, China Poly Group, China Carry Enterprises, and China Xingxing Group. Late in 2006, the Chinese government took this trend to its natural conclusion, announcing plans to fund privately owned, as opposed to government-owned, military equipment producers, thus promoting competition and innovation, and giving the PLA a better choice of products and services when it comes to their core mission. Companies like Shaanji Baoji Special Vehicles, which makes armored personnel carriers, and a host of high-tech firms have stepped in to fill this role, often accepting in the process billions in grants and tens of billions in contracts, all intended to help China close its defense technology gap with the West. This comes at roughly the same time that China is announcing record military spending, with the 2007 budget the highest in 5 years. The increase, officially to nearly $45 billion, is almost 18% more than in 2006. Said a senior partner in one of the West's top private equity firms active in China, "There's twists upon twists on all this. The PLA creates new enterprises in order to get its top guys rich. The government cracks down on the ties when too much money is being made and corruption stories spread. Then these companies are cut loose to become more truly private, more independent, and often more successful. What happens next is illustrated by a dinner I attended not too long ago in Shanghai, when, sitting with the CEO of a big tech company and talking about an upcoming set of meetings in Beijing, he said, "Why do you bother even to see those old men anymore? We are the future power in China." Permanent war's bottom line, a country and an alliance beyond all others. Even in the face of China's rise and its recent increases in defense spending, and despite the hue and cry in the West about the threats this represents, the PRC still has a long way to go to catch up with the undisputed leader in global defense spending, the United States. On the basis of dollars invested alone, more than 50 years of permanent war have confirmed America's status as the world's one true military superpower. According to the highly respected Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, SIPRI, of the roughly $1.2 trillion in global defense spending by governments in 2006, $529 billion, approximately half, was spent by the United States. Approximately 80% of the total was spent by America and its NATO allies. After the United States, according to SIPRI data, the top four spenders are Britain at $59 billion, France at $53 billion, China at $50 billion, note the discrepancy with the official figure cited earlier, and Japan at $44 billion. Only the top 13 spend over $10 billion a year each. Similarly, of the Defense News Top 100 ranking of global defense contractors in 2007, seven of the top 10 are from the United States, and the other three are headquartered in Britain, the Netherlands, and Italy. All of the top 20 are from NATO countries. SIPRI also has an arms transfers project that looks at who is selling weapons to whom. According to that project, the top year for major arms sales was 1982, during the Cold War, when five countries, the Soviet Union, the United States, France, Britain, and Italy, were responsible for 82% of such transactions. Global arms sales have since trailed off and are now about half of what they were 23 years ago, yet five countries still dominate: the United States, Russia, France, Germany, and the Netherlands. Among these, Russia leads the pack due to its price advantages and the fact that many arms purchasers are emerging nations for which price rather than technological sophistication is key. Within the Russian arms operation, though, there is a concentration of buyers. From 2001 to 2005, a full 43% of Russia's sales went to China, and 25% went to India. Thus, these two emerging giants were responsible for over two-thirds of all Russia's export demand. Given its domination of the private arms industry, America's prospects for retaking the top position among arms sellers on SIPRI's lists look good, with the country virtually tied with Russia for market share. During 2001 to 2005, 36% of U.S. sales went to Greece, Israel, Britain, and Egypt, but India and Japan are moving up on the list. The Indian relationship is seen as particularly important because of the potential size of that market, but also because India is now a vital counterbalance, both to an increasingly martial Japan and to a politically unstable Pakistan. Just as military-to-military cooperation among leaders helps promote sales, so do sales help promote long-term political and diplomatic ties. Alliances drive arms sales, and arms sales drive alliances. If Japan, as seems likely, adopts a more traditional military stance going forward, and others in Asia seek to counterbalance China's massive recent spending increase in arms, the market for U.S. sales in Asia would be expected to grow even further. A more forward-leaning Japanese military, as an example, is much more likely to buy the kind of American aircraft they are used to from manufacturers such as Boeing and Lockheed, or augment their fleets of ships featuring advanced defense systems manufactured by Northrop Grumman or Raytheon. Thus, a policy step that the Japanese might take after close consultation with the United States would probably have commercial consequences of direct relevance to the United States and to the leaders and the shareholders of big defense contractors. If this leads to a spiraling upward of other defense budgets in the region, whether in South Korea or Taiwan, two countries that are also big U.S. arms customers, the benefits cascade outward. SIPRI's estimate of major conventional arms sales as a percent of global trade is only 0.5 to 0.6%, itself a fraction of total defense-related sales. This underscores that, in terms of global significance, this is not just a numbers game. Arms sales amount to transfers of the ability to project force and thus alter the balance of power regionally and internationally. Perhaps it is not surprising that, as a consequence, they are the product of such close collaboration at the highest level of political, military, and commercial elites, core groups of the global superclass. The Fly and the Lion. The lesser-known members, or shadow elite, of the world's military powerful are inherently harder to locate geographically or demographically. They include illegal arms traders and terrorist leaders, among others, criminals whose activities transcend borders and cause international instability. Despite their lack of visibility, these individuals have global impact. Potentially using or supplying weapons of mass destruction, they can alter the fates of nations. Many of the headlines and much of the attention in the arms business are associated with the most expensive or destructive weapons. William Longavisha's The Atomic Bazaar, for example, chronicles one of the most destabilizing power-shifting phenomena in global security, the acquisition by poor countries of nuclear weapons technologies. Longavisha calls the acquisitors the nuclear poor, and rightly notes that their possession of such weapons gives these countries and their leaders much greater leverage internationally. Indeed, Bill Clinton once characterized nuclear weapons as North Korea's only cash crop. But the story of how these weapons technologies were trafficked brings into focus several of the most important trends affecting the global arms marketplace. The growing significance of illegal trafficking in weapons or weapons technologies by actors who ignore international regimes, and their ability to ignore those regimes because they have failed or are failing. The effective negation of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT's leverage as a mechanism for limiting nuclear weapons in the hands of just a handful of nations, is the most egregious of these. With the acknowledgement of the acquisition of nuclear capabilities by India, Pakistan, and North Korea in recent years, and the possibility of acquisition by Iran, it is clear that without teeth, the relevance of the regime is fading, spurring on the race by small nations and even non-state actors to acquire the technology. This, in turn, led to the likes of Pakistan's Abdul Qadir Khan, who was discovered to be at the hub of an illegal global trade in such weapons. In the mid-1970s, determined to counter the threat of newly atomic India, Khan stole reactor blueprints from a lab where he worked in the Netherlands and launched his country's own nuclear weapons program, forging his identity as Father of the Islamic Bomb. In the years since, Khan has established a global network for nuclear proliferation and has been charged by courts in Europe and South Africa with conducting business with secret or unsanctioned nuclear programs of at least six countries: India, Pakistan, South Africa, North Korea, Libya, and Iran. Much remains unknown about the full scope of the Khan network, however, and though Khan himself is currently under house arrest in Islamabad, President Bush's 2004 assertion that his administration had put the network out of business seems overly optimistic at best. In August 2006, Steve Call reported in The New Yorker that, like Khan and his many anonymous associates, the entrepreneurial engineers who have emerged as agents of nuclear proliferation covet privacy and rarely explain themselves. Yet their motives and beliefs, professional pride, greed, fear of exposure, and occasionally political conviction, have had, in cases such as Iran, Libya, and Pakistan, as much influence on the nuclear balance as the decisions of prime ministers or presidents. Indeed, one senior U.S. official situates Khan's destabilizing role in the 21st century as up there with Hitler and Stalin in the 20th. Even without a military title or CEO status, men like Khan have the capability to shape world events to an extraordinary and terrifying extent. International terrorists constitute a similar critical component of the shadow class of the military-industrial cluster. They are much more directly involved with the use of force and violence than their counterparts in the arms trade, and the effects of their actions can be no less momentous. In addition to notorious characters like Osama bin Laden, there are others with purportedly similar sway in their respective networks. Terrorist leaders Ayman al-Zawahiri, Al-Qaeda, Ramadan Abdullah Mohammed Shallah, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah, top a long list of individuals whom authorities consider masterminds. The focus on the top guys is, however, partially a result of the media and the public's impulse toward giving a movement a face, personalizing it. While leaders like bin Laden are important, and he and Nasrallah certainly qualify as superclass due to their iconic status, resources, networks, and political links, there are countless examples of terrorist strength in their anonymity. From bin Laden's disappearance into the mountains between Afghanistan and Pakistan to the vanishing of other key leaders, the facelessness and interchangeability of the players suggest that, in the case of terrorism, networks are more important than individuals. The killing of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, for example, did little to weaken the lethal force of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Ironically, the preferred terror technique of many Middle Eastern terror groups, suicide bombing, is not just an effective way of delivering pain to an enemy. It is a metaphor for the movement. Individual identities are extinguishable, expendable. Recently, as the attention given the so-called war on terror has mobilized intensive study of terror networks, it has also become clear that an important part of the capability of these organizations rests in the terror supply chain, the ability to tap into illicit networks of arms merchants, money launderers, drug smugglers, and even peddlers of counterfeit goods to get cash, move it, direct it to weapons purchases, buy false papers, cross borders, bribe officials, do whatever it takes to bring a plan to fruition. Foreign policy editor Moises Naim, in his definitive work on the subject, Illicit, describes thousands and thousands of recombinant networks that can be drawn on to support a particular mission and extend, for cash, the capabilities of terror groups and other illicit enterprises. The Libyan-born Venezuelan-raised Naim, sitting in the living room of his comfortable Bethesda, Maryland home, discussed with me the shadow elites of a global arms trade that seems impossibly remote. "This is a huge economy. This is immensely important and for many hard to see," he said. "But it is what is happening in many countries. In many, the degrees of separation between the legal and the illegal are two or three or none. Go to Russia and find a company that does not have 3 or 4 degrees of separation from a criminal entity. These are new elites," he continued, "very powerful financially and politically. They don't go and they don't need to go to Davos. They do not belong to any of these circles, but often they are financially better endowed and politically more influential than some of the new power elites that appear in business magazines and the fancy party sections of newspapers." Some of them control regional governments, city councils, or have major influence in the military in more than one country, and have governments in their pockets. You know what these people have that the Davos crowd does not have? Guns. So all these financiers from New York and London, the big hedge fund guys, they probably have very big, big pockets. But they do not have guns and thugs, and they are the currency in many parts of the world today. Naeem refers to places like many so-called weak states, in which outlaws rule and the outlaw with the best access to the best weapons is often dominant. If Colombia's rebels and their drug lords, or the drug lords along the U.S.-Mexican border, have access to more cash and, as a consequence, to better technology, they can outplay legitimate forces in those countries and buy or intimidate political leaders as suits their objectives. Among the superclass of the arms dealer community, Naeem cites Victor Bout, called by some the Bill Gates or Donald Trump of modern gun running. In the chaos of the early post-Soviet period, Bout bought a number of outdated Soviet aircraft and, under a complex front of fake businesses and subsidiaries, began a chartered weapons transport service. In the 1980s and 90s, he ferried arms, as well as diamonds, frozen fish, and even UN peacekeepers, all over Asia and Africa. From bases in permissive jurisdictions, he supplied small arms, bombs, and missiles to an unknown number of violent clients from Hutu militias in Rwanda to the Taliban in Kandahar, including an estimated $50 million worth of weapons destined for Al-Qaeda. While we can never know for certain the magnitude of Bout's influence, the arms he supplied undoubtedly affected the balance of power in several civil wars and aided the development of more than one lethal terrorist organization. Until recently, another member of the same tier of shadow elites was 61-year-old Manzer Al-Kassar, a Syrian arms dealer who, thanks to his adopted residence and lifestyle of luxury in Spain, was called the Prince of Marbella. Al-Kassar was undone early in June 2007 by two operatives linked to the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration who claimed they were seeking to buy weapons for FARC, F-A-R-C, Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, Colombia's most notorious terror group and one with deep links to the drug trade. Apparently, Al-Kassar promised to deliver 8,000 machine guns, 2 million rounds of ammo, 120 rocket-propelled grenade launchers, 2,400 hand grenades, and surface-to-air missiles to the agents. In addition, like any major arms corporation would do, he promised to provide trainers to help enhance the productivity of his clients, offering special insights in the construction of improvised explosive devices. And in keeping with the trend in rent-a-soldiers, he offered 1,000 fighters as well. Supposedly the total price tag for the deal was $8 million, but that payoff proved to be just a trap for the terror supporter when he was picked up at the Madrid airport. Al-Kassar has long been seen as a vital link in the networks that empower terrorists, one with a special appetite for anti-American causes. As dramatic as the stories are about missile launchers and loose nukes, it is worth noting in the context of the global arms business that by far the deadliest segment of the arms trade is small arms. The Small Arms Survey 2006 reported that 1 million small arms and light weapons were procured by international militaries that year, with Russia, the United States, Italy, Germany, Brazil, and China the leading exporters. The United States and the EU alone were responsible for 75% of total annual production. It is only a $4 billion a year business, and strikingly, military consumption is only a tiny fraction of the entire trade, with between 7 and 8 million guns traded legally each year, and millions more traded via illegal channels. But whereas deaths from terror attacks were 20,000 in 2006, total homicides related to small arms were 10 times that in the preceding year. The survey emphasizes that almost half of those killed are young men, and that in places like Colombia, with high levels of gun violence, the average life expectancy of males is 3 years shorter than it would be were it not for the gun violence. According to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, these weapons, which account for only one-fifth of the global arms trade, maim and kill far more than any other conventional weapons. For an exemplar of small arms' lethal power, one needn't look farther than the Russian-designed Kalashnikov rifle, better known as the AK-47, which alone has killed many millions since its introduction during World War II, and which has become the weapon of choice for militants around the world. It and other small arms were the most commonly used weapons, and in some instances the only weapons used, in the 101 major conflicts fought worldwide between 1989 and 1996. Here again, a failure of governments to act has created the void that has enabled this most dangerous segment of the arms industry to burgeon. A survey by the UN and a host of NGOs found that many states have out-of-date laws, and almost 100 have failed to enact what is considered to be a minimum step toward the implementation of small arms control. Further, it is estimated that the vast majority, perhaps 9 out of every 10 weapons traded, originated with a state-sanctioned deal. In short, the networks tying the legal arms trade to the black market trade are producing mayhem and death on a mind-boggling scale. Every year, approximately 60,000 to 90,000 people are killed in military conflicts by small arms. But it is not in the interests of the powerful to target this problem. Why? Because it is a problem that does not resonate with political or business leaders. It is a problem of the poorest, and one from which global arms producers are profiting. Ironically or fittingly, such neglect feeds the anger of the small against the large, pushing people toward shadow elites and away from their corporate and first-world counterparts. This creates the environment of asymmetry that is so baffling to many of today's military-industrial elites. The richest and most powerful have perfected a system that gives a few countries, or more accurately, one country and a few people within that country, huge dominance over all the others. But their system also leaves them unprepared and, if Iraq is any indication, almost impotent to face the threat that the fly poses to the lion.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.